Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe on WVKR. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very pleased to have on the show today Brent Sverdlov. Brent is a memory coach and the author of How Could I Forget You? A Creative Way to Remember Names and Faces. And he's talking to us by telephone about something that ought to be of interest to most students thinking about taking final exams in a few weeks, the subject of how to train yourself to remember things. Welcome, Brett.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you here. And I remembered your name, so although I'm reading.
Much appreciated.
So first off, can you tell us how you became interested in memory generally?
Sure, absolutely. Actually, it was a very serendipitous thing. In eighth grade, my English teacher, Mrs. Baker, was out for a day, and a substitute teacher came in. Her name was Mrs. Barnhouse, a very memorable name.
Yeah.
And she told us to put our books away, that she was going to teach us something that they ought to teach in school, but they don't. And that was how to memorize things more effectively. And she taught us a very simple list of 10 words, and we learned them backwards and forwards and by position. And it just stuck with me as something really kind of intriguing. Mm-hmm. And she referenced a book that was fairly new then, that came out in the early 70s by Harry Loran and Jerry Lucas called The Memory Book. Mm-hmm. And I ran to the nearest mall after school and I bought it. And I use the techniques to train myself to memorize more lists and foreign language vocabulary and numbers and all kinds of facts and figures that really served me well through high school and college. So it was just that 1 hour, that chance encounter, and it really put me on a different path in terms of how I retain things.
It's kind of wonderful that she connected with your child's curiosity there, that you actually were motivated to go out and buy the book and then essentially incorporate it into the way you do things. So.
Yeah, I think I was the lone freak in the class on that because I was at a wedding a couple of years ago with some friends who were in the same English class with me. Now, granted, the class was 1978 and this wedding was in 2014 or 15. But I referenced Mrs. Barnhouse, and nobody remembered who she was. Nobody remembered anything about that day. I mean, it really was just one day, but it resonated with me and nobody else.
Nobody remembered her lesson on how to remember things.
Right, which made me think maybe I imagined the whole thing, but that was one vivid hallucination, I have to say, and it made a big difference. I've always been kind of a word nerd, and I just came back from the American Crossword Puzzle Tournament in Stanford this last weekend with Will Shorts and 700 driven cruciverbalists. Solving puzzles and playing word games all night. So anything that has to do with playing with language and words has always fascinated me.
And you were like that as a child then also, at least in the eighth grade.
I was. In fact, when I was 10, my mother took me to see a live production of My Fair Lady with Rex Harrison in it as Henry Higgins. And that totally legitimized linguistics as a career choice for me, as a field of study and then job subsequently. I thought I was the lone word lover, and then there's this guy on stage. It's like, oh, phonetics, that's cool. You just don't know, you know, what's going to grab you and... I was lucky enough that that I saw that show, too. So again, another short encounter that kind of sealed the deal and put me on a track that was really a good fit for me.
So your book is about remembering names and connecting them to faces, something most of us don't seem to do very well. If my own experience of being at a complete loss every time I'm in a room full of people and I'm introduced to people and then 10 seconds later I can't remember their names when I go to introduce them to someone else is the experience of other people. So I suppose, is that why the focus on names? Because they are so difficult to remember.
Yeah, you are in the vast majority of people. And there's a reason, neuroscientifically, why names don't stick. Mm-hmm. And we really have to train ourselves to remember them. Why the focus on names for my book? I used to teach workshops in the greater Boston area that were called Memorize Anything. And we would focus on lots of things. It would be a multi-week class on the things I referenced before, on like foreign language vocabulary, scripts, speeches, names, lots of different things.
Yeah, there are lots of things to remember,
You know, and depending on why people were there, I had law and medical students who had to memorize lots of terminology. I had aspiring firefighters and police officers who had to learn regulations as well as just being more aware of their environment, like remembering license plates and addresses and descriptions of people. So people came from very different backgrounds, and there were some who were just there to enhance their own mental agility. But when we got to names and faces, just as you said, everybody said, I'm terrible with names, but I remember faces, or I'm bad at faces, but sometimes I remember names, and people have their different methods for it. So I really zeroed in on that. also a time issue. There are a number of encyclopedic books on memorization, like the memory book by Harry Lorraine and Jerry Lucas that I mentioned before, and that was sort of beyond my ability to take on. But I thought names would be good to focus on, and I wanted to distinguish my book from what else was out there on the market. Pretty much everything else is black and white print and maybe a stick figure. And I worked with a professional illustrator to include some really fun caricatures to make the learning more vivid.
Yeah, the book is wonderfully illustrated, I have to say. It really kind of it adds a lot to the book. It makes what you have to say easier to remember, too. So,
well, yeah, visual learning. I mean, it's for the people need to see pictures or draw their own pictures. That's part of it, the visualization as well as just the muscle memory sometimes of drawing something out or writing it longhand. And Sarah Goodwin is the very talented illustrator who I worked with on this, and she was just great and using her own imagination with very few constraints that I put on to really make these people come to life and seem almost believable. Mm-hmm. So the other thing that the memory book, the earlier one, focused on was last names. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to focus more on first names because we're a less formal time than we used to be. You know, it used to be you introduced somebody by a full name or Mr. or Mrs. or a title, and now we're much more familiar. So I wanted to focus on first names and also categorizing names by type. Mm-hmm. That no one I'd seen had done that before in print. And so I have a classification system that relies on lots of different things from pop culture to very basic accessible linguistics and ways to play with language, as I said earlier. I think languages are like toys. Mm-hmm. Just a quick aside, there was a book that came out about 4 years ago called The Joker by a man named Andrew Hudgens. Mm-hmm. And he was a compulsive joke teller since he was a child. Oh. And he maintained that for him, jokes are toys made of words. That jokes are toys made of words, and I think that names are toys made of words. That there's something that you can play with, and we should have fun with them.
Names, I mean, apart from being useful in social circumstances, you know, in a group, in a party, or even in a classroom trying to remember your students' names, names come up in other cases. They come up on exams. Certainly, you know, I'm an art librarian, and in the art department here in Art 105, 106, students are required to remember the names of artists and associate them with their works. And oftentimes these names can be rather difficult. I'm thinking, you know, Sophonisba, mm-hmm. Anguissola, but there are all kinds of names. Some of them easy to remember, you know, Vincent van Gogh, because you've heard them so many times, but others right. Not so easy. And so can you talk a bit about how to go about remembering a name?
Of course. Yeah. These are two different contexts. I mean, the first one, the social situation, like you mentioned, if you meet somebody and then 10 seconds later you've forgotten their name, but the conversation moves forward and you know all these personal things about them, like where they grew up and what kind of dog they have and what kind of food they like, you know, but the name is gone, and the odds are they've forgotten your name too. And that's moving really quickly. You don't know if you're going to see them again. Should you invest in remembering this name? And you should if you can. I mean, the goal is to remember more names, not every single name. But there are things that you can do to cement the name and also make your name easier to remember for somebody else. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you meet somebody, you can introduce yourself either as Tom or Thomas, mm-hmm. you know, and help them out. If it's Thomas, say Thomas like the English muffin. Mm-hmm. Or if you prefer Tom, say Tom like Tom Thumb or Tom Swifty or something like that. Mm-hmm. So if you give people a reference, that's really a gift to them. I tell people do that. It makes you more memorable in case they're not using the methods to remember the name and kind of use it in conversation, not overusing it like a used car salesman, but but just using it just to anchor the conversation, ask some questions about it. Oh, were you named for somebody? Are you Thomas the First or the Second? Or because everybody, no matter what their name is, has a backstory to their name. But if you can help the other person out, that's huge. Mm-hmm. But that's happening, you know, in real time, and usually it's spoken and it's not written. Mm-hmm. So when you're talking about an art history class and you have to remember names for an exam, then you actually have the luxury of time to really commit this to memory because you know you're going to need to cough it up later. Yeah. So if you have a Vincent van Gogh, let's say, I mean, that's pretty straightforward. You've seen it. It's short. It's easy to remember. Mm-hmm. For the longer names, this is something that Jerry Lucas, the co-author of the memory book, mentioned in a second book that he wrote years later called Names and Faces Made Easy. He called them zipper words or zipper names, that these are words, and they could be place names, they could be personal names, that they just look so long and complicated, we zip over them and say, why bother? I'm not going to remember it. Mm-hmm. But if you break them down into their component parts and you look at them syllable by syllable, they become less nonsense and they actually have some meaning to each unit. So just an example, I remember meeting somebody named Mr. Nowakowski, which for some people it might be intimidating as a long Polish name. Mm-hmm. But if you think of Noah and cow and ski and Noah's Ark and a cow skiing down a mountain, you know, all of a sudden it becomes alive. It's something that you can visualize. Mm-hmm. And I know that you are a medievalist by training, and visualization is critical. And there was an important late medieval scholar, Giordano Bruno, who said that to think is to speculate with images. So when we think, when we process anything, if we can evoke an image that goes with it, that makes it clearer. That's why when you talk to somebody and you forget their name, which can be abstract or non-literal, but you remember things like, again, the dog or the food or where they grew up, you often form mental pictures of what those things look like or feel like or taste like. So the goal really is to force a sort of synesthesia and create more sensory awareness around things that are otherwise flat.
And we can do this with our imaginations, really, can't you?
That's the whole point. Yeah. It's what actors do to make their characters come to life. It's what we do to make things just more tangible and memorable. Some people do it through visualizing. Some people do it by doing like a dance step or hand gestures. Or some people just do it auditorily. There's poets I've spoken with who say that it's the way the words feel in their mouth. It's the muscle memory. It's like eating something, tasting something. There are all different ways to do it, but it really involves engaging as many senses as you can just to make it take deeper root in your body and your mind.
So you mentioned your eighth grade teacher, the substitute teacher, Mrs. Barnhouse, started off her talk by saying this is something that you won't have gotten in school. And there is, I think, isn't there still a kind of bias against rote memorization, certainly in American education? Although this was, being a medievalist, I know it was the hallmark of a medieval education that you could remember. Thomas Aquinas was known to have been able to recite, literally, backwards and forwards, everything he'd ever read. And, of course, he would dictate sometimes to more than one scribe at a time because he could talk much faster than they could write. He would dictate more than one book at a time, section by section, idea by idea, and sometimes word by word. But we, of course, don't learn like that anymore. We don't memorize a lot. You know, we're all supposed to be learning about critical thinking, not about memory. So do you find that to be the case, that there's a kind of prejudice against memorizing things?
Well, I've certainly heard it said that memorization is a bore and a chore. And I think there is a place for rote memorization. I majored in romance linguistics, and when I had to learn verb endings and tenses, they were drilled into me, but they were almost like a song on Sesame Street, and actually it made it kind of fun. So there is a way to do sort of repetition if you can make it a little bit more joyful. Critical thinking, absolutely there is a place for that. We want people to interpret and, you know, get their head around what they're learning so that they can apply it to other situations. But if we're talking about straight facts, you know, names and dates or battles or word-for-word speeches, things like that, that's a little bit different. That is, there's really black and white answers on that. The bias that I hear these days is really, I can look it up on my phone because my phone is always with me. And why should I clutter my brain with these things? And I respond, well, you could also choose never to walk again or lift your arms because there are segues and scooters and robotic limbs that will do this for you. Now, if you're incapacitated, then these are absolutely critical to helping you move around. But if you're able-bodied, I think it's dangerous for us to give up too much control. And we see this happening where people don't remember even short numbers, like a confirmation number that comes up on an email. They'll take a picture of the screen with their phone. They won't even write it down longhand or commit it to memory. We've given up a lot. And the most looming example of giving up control, I think, is the self-driving car. Every time I hear about that, I mean, talk about shutting out your surroundings, no longer being aware of your environment, being actively discouraged from being aware of your environment so that you can spend more time, texting, searching the internet? You're expected to take control of the car in case there's a critical situation. And I know that they have to program algorithms into these things, that if you're on a collision path with, you know, a person, an animal, or a wall, or something else, the algorithm has to determine which one you hit. And depending on who the person is, or what kind of damage the wall might do, you know, you might make a different one than the computer would. So I think there's definitely a place for technology. I'm not saying scrap it all together, but I worry about over-reliance on digital assistance and saying, I can look it up. Now, granted, we can look things up in dictionaries and encyclopedias and print editions of things, too, but going that extra mile, knowing things, there's a virtue to it. I mentioned the crossword tournament I was at this weekend. If you can remember, you know, lots of obscure facts, it makes you a better solver. And it's like running a marathon. You're training these different muscles. You're training your endurance. You're enhancing your stamina. if you can keep your brain as fit as the rest of your body, memorization is part of that. We shouldn't lose that. You know, we should also be thinking critically, and we should try something new that scares us or that makes us grow, even if we're not good at it. Learning a musical instrument, singing, sometimes even just going for a walk and noticing birds or plants. Just heightening our sensitivity to things and not tuning it out.
Interesting, because from a medieval perspective, the importance of memory has especially to do with the development of virtue, that if you can train your memory, you'll be a more virtuous person. It's just automatically assumed. And often medieval romance, the narrative will be about recovering memories in some way. You know, the protagonist, something will happen early in the narrative, and then he or she will come back to that later in the narrative when a situation comes up and be informed by that earlier experience, and then even reinterpret that earlier experience where it might not be understood early on. So memory is a way of becoming more intimate with the world and with the course of your own life. It has to do essentially with virtue and with relating to the world in a very basic way, which you can't do without memory. I mean, we separate these things out. There's an Aristotelian division, reason, imagination, and memory, but you can't have any one of them without the others. You can't think about anything if you don't have memory. You can't imagine anything without memory, really, and you can't remember anything without imagination.
Right. There was a biologist turned neuroscientist, Gerald Edelman, who won the Nobel Prize, who said something very similar, that in the higher organisms, every act of perception is to some degree an act of creation, and every act of memory is to some degree an act of imagination. So perception and creation, perception exactly, what you perceive is filtered through your life experience, it's colored by that, and so you're creating things around it to give it context, and then when you recall it through your memory, then your imagination is necessary to sort of fill in the blanks, because our memories are imperfect. But you're right about bringing in these other senses of imagination and reason. Our brains are not like the yellow pages where you go back and the same thing is on the same page in print. It's definitely malleable, and our memories change as we gain more experience and forget others. And everything is contextual.
And what we know changes also. I remember Wittgenstein has a famous quote, knowledge keeps no better than fish, meaning you have to keep going back and going over it and reformulating it in terms of present experience. So,
well, that's the thing, too, the use it or lose it aspect of it, that I'm not Rain Man on these things, and really few people are. I mean, you mentioned Thomas Aquinas, you could recall things, but unless you're actively using things on a regular basis, they sort of fade away, and you have to keep them up. And that's true for any actor who's memorized a script. Yes, they knew all their lines to Hamlet, but do they know them now when they're not in character or on stage and need to? Well, probably not. They could dust them off. That's the thing about remembering, too. It's not like all of a sudden you turn a switch on and it's on forever. It's selective, and it can be exhausting. It is like training for an endurance sport. So I caution people, too, that learning these techniques doesn't mean that you're coasting on autopilot and you'll always remember everything you know. That actually becomes kind of burdensome, and people who have, you know, neurological conditions have no control over that. So we can learn from the way they process the world, but ideally we can switch it off and not be constantly performing.
So memory practices like the ones that you teach have a long history in Western education, going back to the memory palaces and other techniques used by ancient teachers of rhetoric, where memory was essentially a division of rhetoric. So the question is, do you draw or think about these historical techniques when you're talking to people about remembering things?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Right, it does go back to the ancient Greeks. And as you say, memory was a critical part of rhetoric, and the Romans picked up on this too, that just as much as if you're writing a speech, coming up with an idea, laying out the ideas in order, choosing the right words, your delivery, and then memory was right up there too as one of the five key aspects of it. So, yeah, so the method goes back to Simonides, about 500 BC, I think it is. It's a colorful story that he was a gifted orator who was invited to a banquet to deliver poetry or a speech. I know he loved poetry. He loved poetry and he loved painting, and this is actually a nice kind of symbiosis because of the imagery and the words. I think he even referred to painting as silent poetry, and poetry was painting that speaks, something like that. So it was gifted in terms of evoking imagery and remembering words. So he delivered his lines, and then he left the banquet, and the building is said to have collapsed right behind him, killing everybody inside and mangling the bodies beyond recognition. And people rushed to him and asked him, if their loved ones or friends were in the room. And he was able to reconstruct all the attendants in the room by position. And if you think about this, and you mentioned this earlier about knowing students' names, and often when we teach, we know them by location in the classroom. And if, God forbid, you left a building and you try to remember who was in that building, you wouldn't think alphabetically or chronologically by age. You would think, okay, this person sits here, this is this person's room or office, and you would go through sort of sequentially to tick off the places. And so that's the idea right behind the Memory Palace, of a mental tour of a physical space that you know well. And the Greeks and Romans laid out very specific parameters for what kind of spaces you should use. And on top of this, you could overlay additional information. So then you could associate an item on a list, a specific idea, with that room. And then you do a walkthrough of the palace, and then you recall the word or phrase or thing that goes with it. So for speeches, you just know like a trigger word in a paragraph, and that keyword reminds you of the rest of the items. For word-for-word things, it's a little bit trickier, and there are divergent sources on how much you should be doing every single word, because that becomes onerous, or if you look at the meter, the rhyme, the rhythm, or something else, which are huge aids in memory, and they're intentionally put in there. Or you've got somebody like beating a drum behind you or providing some kind of percussion, or lighting changes, and those kinds of things also can key you in. So it's fascinating to look at physical spaces and also sort of conceptual structures like the zodiac or, say, the military alphabet, you know, Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, things like that. That those can also be used as memory palaces. You can associate an idea with each thing, something with Alpha, with Bravo, with Charlie, or with the zodiac signs in order, or the calendar, or something else. You can use your body from head to toe. You can do lots of things. So, yeah, the palace can have lots of different configurations that are physical and abstract. And I always work with students to come up with what's best for them. Sometimes we'll do an animal alphabet and say, you know, just come up with your favorite animal, alligator, bear, cat, dog, elephant, fox, whatever it is. And it becomes your own memory palace, and memorize 26 things forward or backward or by position. So it's the thing, too, right, is to throw out the concept and then make sure that people make it their own, because if it doesn't relate to spaces or ideas that they are comfortable with or care about, then they're not going to commit it to memory as seriously.
So space is very important here, isn't it? I mean, we seem to have a natural disposition, some people more than others, for remembering things in spatial arrangements. Maybe it has to do with the fact that organism has to know how to get around its environment, and you have to be able to remember where you've been in order to remember where you want to go.
Yeah, we definitely seem wired for that, for visual and spatial. I mean, the only time this falls apart is if you're in an underground parking garage or a casino. And then it definitely seems intentionally disorienting. But yeah, absolutely, spatially we are. And when we find this too, if you go back to the house you grew up in or someplace you haven't been to in a long time, all of a sudden all these memories overwhelm you when you're back in that space, you know, and you have all these associations to your childhood home about playing in the backyard or a friend who came over or a family meal or something. That spaces are incredibly evocative. Yeah, I mean, you also have the subtlety of maybe certain smells or visuals that go with it, too. But and I know that there are cultures, when I remember this from linguistics, that don't have terms for right and left that are subjective. They just use, you know, the compass points of north, east, south, and west. And they know, even when they're inside a room in an enclosed space, they actually know, like, which way is due west or due north. They just have a really strong sense of their surroundings.
Yeah, I used to think I had a sort of internal compass when I was a child, and I would set out. I grew up in huge industrial suburbs around Detroit, where you could ride your bicycle for 20 miles in any direction and never leave a sidewalk. And so you could easily get lost. And I always managed to know where I was, you know, I don't know how, if I was orienting myself toward the sun or what, and get back. You know, it just seemed like I had a kind of an internal compass. But obviously, a memory for space that I don't know if I have anymore, because I do rely on my GPS now, I have to say, when I'm driving. I have no idea where I am if I don't pull my cell phone out and look.
I mentioned that dependence earlier. Our senses can diminish. We're not required to use them, so we don't. I mean, the good thing is, too, right, we're not at sea without sophisticated instruments and have to, you know, navigate by constellations or wind direction or things like that. But in old times when they had no choice, people had to find their way using environmental clues and their wits and very simple instruments.
You mentioned there are other cues that we use, especially in language, and I was thinking poetry, rhyme and meter, that kind of thing to help you remember. But in terms of memorizing other things than names, say memorizing literary texts, those things are always helpful, and it's helpful to memorize literature, I've always found. I just had a discussion about this with Holly Pepe about Edna St. Vincent Millay, because Holly, when she was studying in Millay's home, when Millay's sister was living there, Vincent's sister, Norma, required that she memorize and then be able to recite her poetry before she would talk about the poems to her. So she did that, and she was telling me, you know, what a boon it was for her to do that, you know, that she incorporated them into herself, you know, physically. Embodied scholarship was one of the terms that came up, although we were talking about the fact that Holly also tried on Vincent's dresses, and I had her model her dresses because she was the same size, but which reminded me of the memorization in an odd way, you know, sort of clothing yourself in the language. But anyway, students don't memorize literature quite the way they used to, but it's a really useful thing to do just as a kind of hobby, I've always found. I have a kind of penchant for it because I grew up in the late 60s, very early 70s, listening to my transistor radio ad infinitum with the top 40 on. And so, you know, we heard those songs over and over again, so that I can still to this day, if I hear a song, I can anticipate the lyrics from Motown or early rock or repertoire that you heard in those days. So music and rhyme are important, but also you can just memorize prose also, can't you?
Yeah, well, there are a lot of directions to go on with this. Yeah, Oliver Sacks wrote a great book, Musicophilia, about this, about how our brain processes music differently. And I talked to a lot of actors, straight play actors, musical theater actors, or a lot of them do both, but in terms of remembering things, and when you have music and rhythm and often choreography that goes with it, it's so much easier to memorize. There are patterns to it, and you have an ensemble with you, and that stuff tends to sink in very quickly and stay, because it's physical, it's mental, it's melodic, it's all these things. The other thing, too, you mentioned clothing. At the same time, Millay's clothing, wearing the dresses, and actors I talked to as well say that getting into character and literally being in the shoes of the character, putting on the shoes or other garments, becoming that character drives memorization, too, because they know that if something is well-written, that in that situation that the character finds him or herself, given who the character is, they could only say what those lines are, that is their function, that is their objective, that being in character, especially if there's an accent or it's a very different character, they have become through their own personal behavior, what they've read, music they've listened to, exercises they've done. It really helps them internalize the lines because they become that character, and that's all that they can say. And that's especially useful when there isn't the meter and rhyme or music. The other thing I've seen a lot of these days and take part in myself are story slams, like The Moth and The Porch. Yeah. And you see this sort of renaissance of storytelling. And it's great. I mean, I am in awe of people who can ad lib, who know the basic structure of something, and then can be comfortable and deliver something, or maybe actually it is rehearsed, but they're so polished that they make it seem like it's ad lib. You never want to sound like it's so slick and rehearsed that the audience feels like it's insincere. Yeah. But I think that these storytelling events, when people can deliver it with the right timing and everything, that takes practice. And also knowing the arc, knowing the progression. It's like the memory palace, too, of going on a journey through your story, and you have different touch points along the way. Again, some keywords. As long as you know what the next word is, that will trigger the rest of the idea. And you wrote the story yourself, so it doesn't matter if you're off a word or two. You get the basic point across. And the other thing, too, that you see these days is a resurgence of trivia nights. At the CrossFit tournament this last weekend, there were these two guys, Tony and John, who run a trivia company for entertainment. And they have more work than they can handle. And they were actually off to do a bridal shower in Connecticut, that because the theme of the bridal shower was, you know, trivia contest. That's like good for them for doing that. So I think it's sort of a response to all this, the digital dependence of I can look anything up whenever I need to, why do I have to learn it, that there's kind of a boomerang effect of, well, no, I want to use my own memory. I want to know this stuff because it's fun, because it's challenging, because it actually connects me more socially to events. And it's the analogy that I draw is, you mentioned the 60s and 70s and the music that you listened to. That was also a time period when kind of synthetic foods were really becoming popular, TV dinners. Mm-hmm. The astronauts went to the moon, and we had Tang, we had freeze-dried ice cream. And we thought that this was the shape of food of the future, that we could synthesize something and then fortify it with the nutrients we needed, and that mm-hmm. that was progress. Yeah. And people realized, yeah, that's really cool, but the stuff tastes terrible.
Yes, yeah.
And I think, but without hitting bottom like that, I mean, those things are still around and they're novelties, but without that, we would not have had this kind of return to, mm-hmm. say, organic farming yeah. or a slow food movement or food networks and things like that, mm-hmm. that people really value food, the source of it, the preparation of it, the social dynamics of preparing it and, you know, growing your own celery or whatever kind of artisanal thing, you know, you do in your backyard, that people rediscover that. And mm-hmm. I think that as that was a reaction to TV dinners, that yeah. now this emphasis on telling a story without notes, being able to solve puzzles mm-hmm. or trivia things without notes is a kind of a logical direction of, all right, we don't need to know anything in our brains, but it's really good for us too.
Yeah. I love it because it's so pre-modern. I mean, you know, if you know yeah. anything about how people spent their days in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, games, word games were just yeah. in the rage. And there were so many kinds of word games and contests of wit, that kind of thing.
There are health benefits to it. One of my favorite jobs, I lived in California for most of my life, and I ran an improvisational theater company in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And there were lots of word games. There were very collaborative games. And people think of improv as scary, like it's stand-up comedy, but mm-hmm. it really is like playing in a sandbox as a tyke with other kids. You take your pail, your sand, you make stuff up. You make an airplane, you make a castle, you make whatever you want, mm-hmm. and you do it collaboratively. And so people would come up with stories or play a game called Word at a Time Story, where you say a word that can grammatically follow the previous word, and you just never know where it's going to go, but it makes you think faster on your feet. Mm. And people who came to these improv classes, you know, they loved it. They couldn't get enough of it. And some of them would tell me that they stopped going to therapy. They stopped taking antidepressant medication. Mm-hmm. They had been single, and now they met somebody. They were more open to the compromises of dating and coordinating with somebody else. But freeing up our minds like that and playing word games and really playing is so critical because of the social animals that we are,
yeah.
that even though we feel so connected through a lot of social media sites, that there's kind of an illusion there, and we're not fully engaged because we're not reading the person's nonverbal body cues and sniffing them and just watching movement. And we need to get back to that. And it helps us remember more, and it's just better for our minds and our souls.
Can technology help us remember things? I mean, not just substitute for memory, but, you know, I just got a subscription to, what's it called? I can't remember.
Oh, I'm sorry. But it's not
working.
No, you just haven't made it.
Rosetta Stone. Yeah, I just got a subscription to Rosetta Stone.
Rosetta Stone, yeah.
A language learning app. It doesn't do anything much that the old textbooks didn't do, except it does it in a little bit different way. But, you know, I wonder if one could help exercise one's cognitive abilities by using an app rather than using technology to sort of replace what we do naturally.
Right. It's definitely a supplement, but not a replacement for it. I mean, you're talking about language learning. I've used the Pimsleur method for learning languages. I went to Romania on vacation last year, and I used the CDs to get the pronunciation down and learn some conversational phrases that really helped me. But yeah, you have to keep using it in order to remember it. So that was really more of kind of on-the-go technology to learn. I mean, remembering, there's certainly things out there that are meant to challenge you with pattern recollection and things like that, that, you know, I think doing a crossword puzzle could also do with pen and paper or pencil and paper, but so could just reading a book or going for a walk. It's a tricky thing. There is a place for technology. Does it need to remember for you? It can prop you up. I mean, it can give you clues and reminders, but you don't want to get to the point where you stop caring and let it do all the work for you.
Yeah.
Am I happy I don't have to split my own wood, that I can go pick it up? I don't have to walk 100 miles to the tournament. I can drive a car. Well, yeah, I'm super happy about that. So it makes our lives easier, but I think the rut that we're in danger of falling into is that we rely so much that we lose touch.
Yeah. I remember when I was an undergraduate, I had to do a lot of memorizing. I mean, it was just 105, 106, and it was especially in the social sciences and the sciences. I mean, vocabulary was a huge part of what we had to remember for our tests and exams. And, you know, I developed techniques, flashcard-type techniques, to do this. So do you find with students that some disciplines are more memory-hungry than others, or do you help students with memory techniques who are studying for exams?
Oh, absolutely. I mentioned in my earlier workshops I did in Boston with aspiring firefighters and law enforcement officials and doctors, lawyers. They have lots of terminology to learn. You can even memorize the periodic table if you need to with these methods. There's a great number system that came into being around the 16th century that I use all the time. I use it to memorize actually all the best pictures since 1928, when the Academy Awards were started. Oh. And that's my kind of trained monkey parlor trick that I do. Give me a year after 1928, and I'll tell you what movie won Best Picture. Yeah. And I actually did that at the CrossFit tournament last weekend. But what's amazing is there are people who know a lot of these things, too, because they're just hungry and thirsty for trivia, and they knew a lot of the years. I can do it pretty fast, and I'm trained at it, but I'm always amazed when people can do that with cards or something else.
Yeah.
So definitely subject specificity. Sure, you can use this, and that's actually when you succeed the most, because you're really invested because you have to pass these exams because it's your career choice.
Yeah.
So it's not just the parlor tricks by any means. It's really committing important things. You need to learn the skeletal system, the muscles, the syndromes, what symptoms correspond to diseases. Absolutely. And there are the wordplay techniques, but there's also the tried and true, just kind of rewrite your notes longhand. Mm. It's like learning a foreign language. You need to be able to write and read and speak and understand.
Mm-hmm.
Also with actors learning lines. They'll read their lines, write them out longhand, speak them and record them, play them back and listen to them. And we should be doing that with anything that we take seriously as study, whether it's art history or nuclear physics. There are other powers of observation, subjective judgment that comes into it. And I'll mention that again, the CrossFit tournament, that there's this guy, Matt Ginsberg, who's a brilliant computer scientist, and he created a program called Dr. Phil, F-I-L-L, that can complete the crosswords, you know, in seconds, that it can take us minutes or hours to do. And then after each puzzle, they'll talk about where Dr. Phil got something wrong or got something right. And sometimes if there's a very clever theme, one of the puzzles had the answer maroon 5 in it with the number 5.
Mm-hmm.
And so the program didn't expect to find a number in a crossword grid, and so it got that question wrong. But everybody else who knew there's only one space here, this has to be the number 5 because it goes with the across clue for, for 5.
Yeah.
So, and he'll explain why the machine didn't get that. And it's because machine learning is, I mean, the computers can process things very quickly, but they're only as good as the information that they're fed. So he, you know, will put in dictionaries and he'll put in, you know, past puzzles to compare, and there had never been a past puzzle as the first one of the tournament with a number in it. So the machine didn't know. It just didn't have that knowledge to work with. So it's only as good as what is humanly fed into it, and then the processing takes over from there. So it's not like the machine can make itself smarter and really interpret things subjectively. It relies on the team of scientists to keep making it better based on these miserable failures. Yeah. Okay, so next time we know to do this.
Yes.
But something else will always come up. And humans get things wrong too, there's no question. But there are times, like, you know, we know from an Agatha Christie novel or Inspector Morse or something else, that there are other experiences that we bring in that a machine wouldn't have that give us clues and help us solve the mystery.
Yeah, especially on the processing side, as our friend Sally Kyle would tell us, intuition being foremost here. So
intuition is huge. I mean, sometimes it's a distraction. Sometimes it's an influencer in a, you know, maybe a negative way. But that's the thing, too, about aging. We've gained more experience and say, I know this situation. I've been in this before. And, yeah, so I bring this to bear. And it's something I tell my students, too, especially the older ones, to say, yeah, I'm not 20 anymore, and my brain's not as elastic. And it's like, yeah, but you have more life experience to draw from.
Yeah.
And that's actually a huge asset.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very interesting. So do you get elderly people worried about Alzheimer's coming to ask to help?
By elderly, you mean over the age of 25.
Over the age of 25,
Yeah. Absolutely. In fact, initially, it's funny, my first students, when I started teaching, this is like 2004, they were all senior citizens.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, as medical science finds ways for us to live longer, we want to make sure that health span keeps up with lifespan and that we're, you know, we have all of our marbles as long as possible. So they definitely looked at me as a sort of faith healer, which I'm not. I'm not even a scientist. I am a linguist, I'm lots of different things, but on the liberal arts side, sort of applied imagination expert, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So can you be as limber at 80 as you were at 20 and doing yoga? Maybe not, but you can do more than you're doing now with these techniques.
Yes,
so yeah, it's managing expectations. You know, why do you want to learn this? I mean, the best thing you can do really is, especially if you're older, is just remain socially active. These people in their 90s who play bridge once a week. It's mentally engaging, it's physical, if they have to walk to get there, just move themselves to the place. And then it's socially connecting too, because they're playing with friends.
Yeah.
That social, physical, and mental are the biggest things as a trifecta to keep your body and mind youthful. But it's interesting, over time, my students have skewed younger, in the 20s and 30s. Sometimes they're students who have a lot of information to digest, But sometimes it's an artifact of having spent too much time on, digital technology. And those of us who grew up with hard copy, distinguishing the source of information, say a magazine, a newspaper, a book, or a handwritten letter, if you think about your interaction with those different mediums, about the weight of the paper, the finish on it, the motions required to turn a newspaper page versus a book page, the sound that it makes, even the smell of it, you often remember things by position on a page, where you were when you were reading it. And now with everybody kind of on the go and all that different information being funneled through a screen, it's easy to forget the source, and even if the source was authoritative. Mm-hmm. Was it a Facebook posting, or was it actually a fact-checked article in a trusted periodical? So we don't remember as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that people who grew up on digital feeds may be missing out on something. It's easy to recover, to start using more hard copy, but I definitely see that as a liability.
Well, the page is a kind of architecture. I mean, it is spatial, and they knew this very well in the Middle Ages when someone like Thomas Aquinas could essentially learn to remember everything that had been ever written up to his time, but he was able to do that because of, to some extent, the presentation on the page.
Right.
That's what all these sort of architectonics of the page and the apparatus on the page was about. It's not about substituting for the memory. It's about helping the human brain remember what's there. And it's always struck me as interesting. There's even a kind of opportunity for downtime built in the marginalia, and that especially if a text is dense, there'll be these little odd drawings and images in the margins that seem to have usually nothing to do directly with the text that allow you to take your eye away from the text and your brain away from the text and relax for a few minutes, and then you can go back to it. And it's all to help you remember what you're reading there. So.
Yeah, it's the palate cleanser between courses.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, looking away, it's something that's not text to give your mind a chance to sort of recover and maybe view the information in a different way. It might be a graph, it might be a picture, or like you say, completely unrelated, and you make the connection yourself. You imagine why it's there. And the other thing about books, too, is this is a really good term that I discovered in a book that just came out a couple of months ago by David Sachs called The Revenge of Analog, Real Things and Why They Matter. And he talks about finishability of a book, that the progress that you're making by the number of pages left. You know, you may count ahead to the end of a chapter, but you get a sense that you're making progress and that the end is in sight, or you know where it is. You can see the finish line. And when you're on, say, a website and there are hyperlinks in an article and you can keep going forever, it never ends. Mm-hmm. And that can be exhausting, even subliminally, that are you expected to know all this? How far are you supposed to go? Mm-hmm. It just stretches on. But in a book, it's contained in that volume, and I think it's less stressful.
Yeah,
you can go back and read the page and if you need to, but it's not the stairway to forever.
Yeah, that's true. There's a finiteness about it and a handiness also.
It never runs out of batteries.
No,
24/7, you can pull it off your shelf, it's recharged, ready to go. Yeah.
So kind of philosophical question, I wonder, someone like yourself who's trained your memory over the years, since eighth grade, does having a trained memory affect the way you approach the world generally? I mean, just the way you think, the way your mind operates at all. I mean, from a medieval perspective, again, you would almost necessarily be a more virtuous person than your average person because you've got a trained memory. But I don't know if you feel that's the case. But anyway, do you feel that it affects who you are and the way you are in the world, the way you interact with the world?
Oh, absolutely. But I think that's true for anybody. If you're a botanist, you're more attentive to plants. If you're a astronomer, you look at the stars and you see more. You have a different sort of visual literacy about your environment. So, like I said, I've always liked playing word games and I associate things. So I think it's, nice thing about going to the crossword tournament, too, is that I don't feel like such a geek. And I'll never be the oddest person in the room who likes to play word games and things like that, or notices strange things or makes odd connections among things. So that's very validating. I know that there's a positive side to noticing things in a different way. Mm-hmm. And it's influenced by the foreign languages that I studied. Yeah. A word may remind me of something that I remember from a Hittite class way back, or Gaelic or something else, or there's an interesting number and I know the number system that's phonetic for memorizing those, so I'll make a word out of a number. It could be an address or a license plate or a phone number I see on a billboard. Mm-hmm. So I look at things as a way to practice them, and sometimes it's just sort of a funny association. It's like having a personal backstory to something.
So I know you teach Spanish, but you also do other kinds of workshops and outreach, don't you, in memory?
Absolutely. I go to libraries, wellness centers. I'll be at the Omega Institute the first weekend of June, mm-hmm. doing a three-day intensive on names and faces, scripts and speeches, and facts mm-hmm. and figures.
So anybody in the area, I would expect, can sign up for that. Right?
Yeah, people come from all over the world, but it's right in Rhinebeck. It's a few miles from campus. And if people check my events page, my memory website is flexyourmemory.com, mm-hmm. and there's an events page link, and you can see what's coming up. I'm doing a lecture on the Memory Palace at the Rhinecliff Library in May, doing an adult ed class in Red Hook later in April. So lots of things are coming up. I was at a conference back in January for tour operators out in Cleveland and helped them with memorizing their speeches and names and faces of passengers and coworkers. So everybody can use this stuff. I love doing it. And again, I hope to expedite that revolution of going back to the sort of retro idea of the pre-technology of not virtual reality, but real reality, of let's use our God-given talents and develop them as much as we can.
Are you planning any other books after this first book?
Oh, I would love to, without it being too technical. I'm still looking for a publisher for my current book. I self-published it through Bookshop Santa Cruz, so that might determine a direction. I've had an idea on a back burner for the last few years, and I've been collecting anecdotes for, in terms of memorable experiences. Working title is How Not to Behave. Lessons we've learned from negative role models in our lives. And everybody has stories about, you know, the bad boss, piano teacher, sports coach, whatever it is, who made such an impression about how not to teach something or treat people that it's made them better people. And if you look at, you know, the current political landscape, I think we have some really prime examples.
Yes, we do.
You know, that's really a memorable example of
Sally, or don't do that, Johnny. don't be like the president of the United States. It's a powerful educational tool, the negative exemplum, as they knew in the Middle Ages. They were all full of them.
Goofus and Gallant from Highlights Magazine.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Goofus and Gallant. I have this vivid memory of a few months ago seeing two YouTube clips side by side. One was of Barack Obama pulling up to a curb where he was supposed to meet a dignitary who was standing on the side of the curb with an entourage. And he gets out of the limousine, he goes around to the other side, he opens the other door, and Michelle comes out, and then he escorts Michelle around the car, and he introduces her to this dignitary, very graciously, you can see. And then there's a clip. It looks like it's the same spot in almost the same limo of limo pulling up and Donald Trump jumping out of the back seat and racing to shake the hand of another dignitary while his wife gets out of the other door and just kind of wanders around the back of the car and sort of stands there looking lost. And I thought immediately Goofus and Gallant from Highlights for Children, you know, so long. So you're thinking about writing a book about negative examples, you know, how
I've
not
been
to behave.
Collecting stories. Friends have been very forthcoming with stories about that. And we'll see. But I think what I need is a short-term goal or a hard deadline. When I wrote my last book, I was 48, and my goal was, by the time I'm 50, I need to get this book done. I don't have kids. This is going to be my progeny. So I'm 52 now. I'm like, what's my next milestone that I need to get something out by? And because I'm doing other things too with constructing crosswords and just trying to keep up reading books in Spanish because I teach Spanish at a community college. So I want to keep that language going strong. I mean, we're all doing lots of different things, and I haven't had the lightning strike yet to really make it a book.
We all look at other people for examples of how one shouldn't behave, but I suppose all of us, when we look at ourselves, there are passages in our lives that we might...
Oh, I'm sure I've been a negative role model for other people, too.
Yes, yeah. So.
I've been a manager, so I'm sure. and that's... Yeah, I remember it was actually one of the worst bosses I ever had, gave me this book by Branson called Coping with Difficult People. And in fact, I needed it really more to cope with this boss than with anybody else. But the question that's not asked in there that should be, that when I give the book to other people, is, you know, figure out which type you are. You know, are you the bulldozer or the sniper or the super agreeable, or you know, you always say yes but never follow through, or because we all do that to some extent, and we you know, we know that we're inconsistent and flawed in some way, but you know, we never see ourselves as monolithic category. So yeah, that self-awareness is important. Okay, you know, how can I be better too? And that's just part of awareness in general, really taking stock, and you know, how can we make ourselves better people and more engaged and listen more, you know, listen more than we talk, which is also a mantra of the improv set, that it's so important. And I think if we listen more, we remember more, and it's all really tied into memory as a virtue. And maybe that's what the ancients were saying, is that when you remember things, it means that you paid attention. It means that you looked up, made eye contact, you were respectful, you repeated words back to somebody. You let them know that you care. And the thing that I make clear in my book is that when you remember somebody's name, it's a small thing, but to them, it's so important. It's the most beautiful word to them. You ask them a question about it. It shows that you're interested. Mm-hmm. And they often assume that you remember more about them than you probably do. Mm-hmm. So it's really just being a more present, respectful human being.
That's a nice note to end on. So I want to thank you, Brent, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe today to talk about your book, How Could I Forget You? A Creative Way to Remember Names and Faces, which can be purchased on your website, Candid, at...
FlexYourMemory.com.
FlexYourMemory.com. So
yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so anyway, thanks for joining us today. So
my pleasure, Matt. I really appreciate you having me on your show.